From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kest. We're on the record. A new report by the nonprofit Job Opportunities Task Force dives deep into the ways the poor in Maryland are at greater risk of criminal charges or penalties. Karen York, executive director of JOTF, says the poor face consequences that are blind to their ability to pay. A minor traffic violation can snowball into a tough choice with even tougher repercussions.
They got to go to work. They have families to support. And so they're going to drive on a suspended license. And now they get picked up. And so they're back into the system. And whatever fines and fees that come with that, it's just compounded so that they stay in the system and they're never able to really get out.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Kest. Let's say you have a broken taillight you can't afford to fix. While driving home from work, you are pulled over for this minor traffic violation. Your options are to pay the fine within 30 days or contest the ticket. You don't have the money to pay, but you also can't miss work to go to court to contest it. You skip court. Your license is suspended, and each time you drive, you risk an even more expensive punishment, a 60-day jail term and a $500 fine. This is the kind of scenario laid out in a new report by the Job Opportunities Task Force. The report is The Criminalization of Poverty, How to Break the Cycle Through Policy Reform in Maryland. The Job Opportunities Task Force, JOTF, is a nonprofit that advocates for policies and programs that can increase the skills and incomes of low-skill, low-income workers and job seekers in Maryland. The report identifies many ways in which poverty makes people, especially people of color, susceptible to criminal charges or penalties. It includes recommendations to solve the problem. Karen York is the JOTF's executive director, and she's here with me. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you.
How do you define criminalization of poverty?
Quite simply, the Job Opportunities Task Force has found that you have individuals who are living in certain conditions and situations. And many of these situations disconnect them from the mainstream economy and many of our systems and resources and services that are available to well-off residents and citizens. And so because these individuals are less likely to be able to access these opportunities, they're more likely to actually engage with the criminal justice system. And we know that engagement with the criminal justice system limits your economic opportunity. And so that interaction with the criminal justice system now is the cause of your poverty. You are now, for some reason, subject to greater fees and costs as a result of your poverty. These aren't things that a program can fix. These are actual laws, policies, and practices that allow for the effective criminalization of some of our most poorest, most vulnerable Marylanders.
And so that's why it fits into the bailiwick of the Job Opportunities Task Force.
Absolutely. You know, Job Opportunities Task Force, we're a statewide independent nonprofit, but we're based in Baltimore City, and Baltimore City has always been our base. And over the years, as we've tried to work on and support and promote policies and programs that seek to eliminate educational and employment barriers for our low-wage workers, increasing their skills and their job opportunities, we found that in Baltimore City, there is an intersection that we cannot ignore, and that intersection is the intersection of incarceration, employment, and race. And we found that a significant portion of our working population was effectively unemployable as a result of their interaction with the criminal justice system. This insight, or this light bulb that went off for JOTF a couple of years ago, just happened to coincide with an event that happened in April of 2015, and then a subsequent report that was issued by the Department of Justice 2 months later.
And that event, of course, was the death of Freddie Gray.
Absolutely. And so the death of Freddie Gray and the subsequent uprising, when the CVS finished burning and the media, the out-of-town national media went away, our policymakers and business leaders and others started to realize realize, oh my goodness, many of these communities are struggling and have been struggling for decades. And so we need to think of things a bit differently. How do we start looking at our communities in a way where you have certain communities that have the highest levels of incarceration, but also have the highest levels of unemployment and illiteracy and lack of affordable housing and access to healthy foods? And so we're finding that in these poor neighborhoods, these individuals, they're poor, they're more likely to interact with the criminal justice system, and therefore more likely to be under or unemployed, and therefore more likely to then re-engage with the underground economy.
I gave an example of a minor traffic violation and how resolving that is much more complicated when you're poor. What other policies does this report look at?
So there are a number of policies that look at reducing the use of driver's license suspension as a punitive way to enforce payment of fees and fines. Job Opportunities Task Force, in addition to our work on the policy scene in terms of pushing policy initiatives, we also run and have for the past 12 years a pre-apprenticeship construction training program, Project Jumpstart. And this program consists of individuals who are suffering with significant employment barriers, and they are trained and placed in industry employment in carpentry, electrical, and plumbing. What we find is that a significant number of our individuals are dealing with driver's license suspension as a result of non-driving factors. These are not moving violations. So many of our participants and graduates end up having their driver's license suspended, not because of multiple moving violations or because they were reckless on the road, but for something like inability to pay child support. And so instead of differentiating between a deadbeat dad, someone who's not paying, or a deadbeat mom, someone who's just not paying, or a dead broke dad or mom, someone who wants to pay but can't pay, what's happening is if you're not paying quick enough, if you're not paying the amount that we think you should pay quick enough, then we will, the state of Maryland will suspend your driver's license 60 days within non-payment of your child support orders. Now, we all know that transportation, having stable, viable means of getting to work, is very crucial to you being able to secure employment and maintain employment. And so if you suspend someone's driver's license, how are they going to get to work? For our constituents, for the population that we represent, they got to go to work. They have families to support. And so they're going to drive on a suspended license. And now they get picked up. And so they're back into the system. And whatever fines and fees that come with that, it's just compounded so that they stay in the system and they're never able to really get out. What this report does is look at how can we reduce the use of driver's license suspension for inability to pay things like child support. And we're not using it in a manner where it's punitive and you're now blocking their ability to get to work so that they can be able to pay things like child support or whatever fines and fees they have.
That's Karen York, Executive Director of the Job Opportunities Task Force, JOTF, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a new report by JOTF that examines laws and practices that fall disproportionately on poor people. How are child support payment levels determined?
The interesting thing about it is that the system uses imputed orders or imputed numbers, and what that means is if you have a child support order set against you and you're before a judge and the judge is trying to determine how much your child support order should be, and so you are unemployed, you have no jobs, you have no pay stubs to show, the judge unfortunately cannot move forward with saying you don't have any wages, you don't have anything to show, so they have to put a number in. And so what they will put is the minimum wage. And so your child support order is based on the fact that you're making monies that you're not actually making. And so you actually already start off in arrears based on a policy that requires a judge to impute a number or a wage that actually doesn't exist.
But looking from the other perspective,
mm-hmm.
the parent with full-time custody who's mm-hmm. trying to raise this kid or these
mm-hmm,
kids.
Mm-hmm.
4 out of 5 parents with custody have incomes that are less than 3 times the federal poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of income for most mm-hmm, parents
mm-hmm.
with custody. That missed payment may hurt the child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, this is why it's important to have these conversations, because we are actually trying to figure out how to get the monies back into the hands of the child and the family. We're not trying to absolve the non-custodial parent of any obligations that they have. But just going back to the statement that I made earlier, the deadbeat parent versus the dead broke parent. Right now, our child support laws and policies and determinations are set in a very antiquated, punitive way that penalizes the non-custodial parent instead of figuring out how can we make sure that we're coming up with orders that will allow the family to maintain a good relationship and still ensure that parents are able to pay. Because yes, the custodial parent has the child in their home and is taking care of housing and all of these other critical services, and that cannot be ignored. However, if we also want the non-custodial parent to contribute, then we cannot require that the non-custodial parent provide all of their income and send the income not just to the custodial parent, but we also have to remember the state owed arrears. So if the custodial parent requests an order for public benefits, the state requires the non-custodial parent to have to pay the state back. And so that's not monies that are actually going to the family. That's going back to the state and to the general fund. So you have a non-custodial parent who has child support orders to the custodial parent and to the state if there are any state-owed arrears, and this person is still expected to have their own home and still be able to be engaged in the child's life. And so it's just a matter of how can we take a step back and figure out how much money is necessary to ensure that the child is able to be housed and clothed and has proper schooling and all of the necessary resources, while shared parenting is also a piece of this to ensure that it's not just so one-sided where the non-custodial parent is just a paycheck.
And you, so you're recommending what to solve this problem?
So we are recommending a number of policy initiatives that we've actually been pushing for a number of years. So the first one, again, is around driver's license suspension. This is an initiative where even you're finding employers that are supporting this. If there's a way to not allow driver's license suspension within 60 days, space it out a bit more, or find other enforcement mechanisms that would allow an individual to pay that's not taking away their means for transportation to be able to get to work so that they can pay. Some other things that we're looking at is increasing awareness around the state child support forgiveness program. A couple years ago, the state worked with Job Opportunities Task Force and some other partners to create the child support payment incentive program, where the non-custodial parent owes state-owed arrears. And these, again, are monies that are not going to the parent. They're going to the state. If you are able to make consecutive payments for 12 months, whatever you work out with child support will forgive 50% of your arrears. If you do it 24 months in a row of consecutive payments, they'll forgive 100% of your state-owed arrears. So they're not forgiving the monies that's owed to the parent and the child. They're forgiving monies that's owed to the state. Unfortunately, there's only one jurisdiction in the state of Maryland that's actually utilizing this program, Baltimore City. And so how do we increase awareness around the state so that more individuals know about this program and more individuals are getting out of debt owed to the state so that they can contribute more monies to the family? We're also looking at how to just reduce many of these punitive child support enforcement policies around wage garnishment. Right now, you can garnish up to 68% of one's wages as a result of non-payment of child support. What we are hoping that our policymakers will do is work with us to look at many of the current laws and policies on the books to see what do we need to modify, what needs to be eliminated, what needs to be made more robust. How do we make sure that we are reforming our child support enforcement practices and policies in a way that ensures that parents are able to meet their obligations and that the child is not stuck in the middle?
We need to take a quick break here on the record. I'm speaking with Karen York, head of the nonprofit Job Opportunities Task Force, about ways in which the poor are vulnerable to criminal penalties. When we come back, more of JOTF's recommendations for reform. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're learning about a study by the Job Opportunities Task Force titled The Criminalization of Poverty, How to Break the Cycle Through Policy Reform in Maryland. The report identifies policies and practices in Maryland that target the poor, do not take a person's income into account when setting fees, or penalize the poor for not being able to pay off fines. Karen York is with us. She's executive director of the nonprofit, which advocates on behalf of low-wage workers and job seekers. Your report looks at a whole pattern of practices you say fall disproportionately on poor people and affect their ability to get or hold jobs. What is the policy you think the public is least aware of?
I would say auto insurance. Auto insurance is something that folks don't really think about because it's something that we all have to have, right? Auto insurance is required by law. The problem is that many insurance companies, if not all insurance companies, are setting insurance premiums, many times using non-driving factors. So they're using things like credit, occupation, income, education level, zip code, a whole host of other factors. To set your premium. And now these factors are, in effect, race neutral, but end up having a disproportionate impact on Black men and women. And so what we find is individuals who may live in, say, Charles Village or Roland Park or the Guilford area, their insurance premiums are actually a lot less than the folks in, say, maybe the Park Heights or Sandtown Winchester. And these are the communities that have predominantly African-American residents. And so if we know by law that you have to have auto insurance, yet we know that 40% of monthly gross income is going towards car insurance for many of these individuals who are subjected to these high premiums, then you're finding that individuals are having to make very tough choices. They're having to decide whether or not they're actually going to use their monthly wages for things like rent and food, or if they're going to appropriate monies for car insurance. Even when we bring this up in Annapolis, it's shocking that our policymakers are shocked to hear that the insurance companies will admit, yes, if you are a widower, if you are divorced, if you, you know, have a certain credit rating, or if you live in a certain neighborhood, you are more likely to be subjected to higher insurance premiums.
So what are you recommending?
So what we're recommending is that two things. One, that Maryland adopts a low-cost auto insurance program similar to what's available in California. And this would provide another opportunity for those Marylanders who are not able to secure these high coverage premiums, but they're still able to be covered in a safe manner in a way that allows them to be on the road and still be protected. The second thing that we're looking at is the elimination of non-driving factors in setting insurance premiums. It's just that simple. My ability to pay bills should not determine whether or not I'm going to be a dangerous or safe driver. If there's no good reason to use a non-driving factor to set an insurance premium, if there's no good reason to use a non-driving factor to set risk, then it should be eliminated. And that's what we're seeking to do this year.
Civil asset forfeiture allows law enforcement agencies to seize property from individuals without a warrant or conviction if they suspect the property has been involved in criminal activity. How does this happen?
Many individuals who live in those communities that we identify as over-policed and underserved. Underserved at times means unbanked. Many of the residents are distrustful of banks, and so they do not deposit their monies in banks. They prefer to operate using cash because, unfortunately, in our community, in the African-American community, there's a reason for a distrust with the banks, given many of the predatory policies and practices that were waged in our community. And so because many of the individuals that live in these over-policed communities are unbanked, this means that they are walking around with their paychecks on them. And so if you live in a community where you're going to be more likely to interact with the criminal justice system for whatever reason, we found from the DOJ report that, you know, just depending on where you live, walking could have you stopped by police officers asking where you're going or what you're doing. And so we find that there are many individuals in these communities that are stopped, and law enforcement, because they're under the impression that these communities are high crime areas, then they stop these individuals and find that they have more money than they think that they should have. And so as a result, that money must be tied to some criminal activity. And as a result, then we're going to seize that. We're going to require that if you want to retrieve this, then you have to go through this whole process of having to prove that the money is yours. And so, again, we find that this is more likely to happen in those communities where you don't have community banks or you just don't have banking options at all. So as a result, they're walking around with their monies on their person.
And so what happens to these assets that are seized?
So many times the assets are used to fund local initiatives, local correctional initiatives.
It goes to the city?
It could go to the city. It could go to the state. You know, it could also be used to support local programs and services, for instance, survivors, domestic violence. And this is not to say that those programs should not be supported. But, you know, many times, you know, these individuals already have a distrust with law enforcement. And so they're not going to come back to try to prove that these monies are mine.
What is your highest priority to get from the General Assembly this session?
In terms of the criminalization of poverty, there are two. The first is one we did not talk about much, and it has to deal with the entry point into criminal justice many times. And I think we've talked about it before, and it has to do with cash bail. Over the years, Maryland has debated, deliberated over the use of cash bail in the criminal justice system. And we found, particularly in the last year, that there are a number of individuals that are held pretrial, not because they're a flight risk or because they're a danger to society, but because they can't make a bail amount of more than $1,000. And so the Maryland Court of Appeals ruled that judges, when making bail determinations, that they must consider an individual's ability to pay. And if you're going to assign a cash bail, it cannot be a bail amount that the individual cannot afford, because if they cannot afford it, then they must be detained. And so you have essentially just detained them because they're poor. But the other piece to that rule depends on the legislature, and that's investing in pretrial services. Many times we find that individuals are engaging with the criminal justice system because they are lacking access to basic resources and services, drug treatment, mental health services, job training, educational assistance, a whole host of critically important resources and services that very well could have led them away from criminal activity. And so the equally important piece of the rule is investing in pretrial services, ensuring that we are investing in those services on the front end so that individuals can actually stay away from the system on the back end. Once they exit, they can actually stay out, because we've already started the process of connecting them with those critical services that they may not have had access to when they were outside of the system. So that's on the front end. On the back end, it's expungement. Over the years, Maryland has adopted a number of laws that would increase access to expungement for individuals.
Expungement meaning wiping out a previous conviction.
Absolutely. Not just conviction, criminal record. So when it comes to expungement, we're talking about if you go on something like Maryland Judiciary Case Search, which is unique. Other states don't have this. You either have to pay or you have to get a court authorization to look up someone's record. But in Maryland, if you have internet access, you can go on Maryland Judiciary Case Search and pull up someone's record. There are individuals who have records from 10, 20 years ago. Many of these offenses are non-convictions, meaning they were not found guilty. It's not a conviction. Many of them are not just dated, but they're minor offenses. But yet they're on someone's record. And so when an employer or a landlord or, again, anyone with internet access pulls this information up, they're able to see it and then make a judgment against you based on that and you not even having to be in front of them. And so given the conversation around the country, around the intersection of incarceration and employment, you know, the fact that America is the most incarcerated country in the world and how one in three U.S. adults have some type of arrest record that's going to appear in a routine background check. This is according to the National Employment Law Project. Given that we know all this, many states are starting to move to allow for expungement. Once years have passed and you have not reengaged with the criminal justice system, you should be able to limit public access to that criminal record, because that criminal record should not define you at where you are right now. That criminal record is a snapshot of the most embarrassing, horrible time in your life. one of your worst decisions. And so how do we ensure that as you're trying to move past that, once you've turned your life around and you're trying to access, you know, those opportunities that will ensure that you stay away from that system, how do we make sure that you have access to things like expungement that will allow that record to not follow you around everywhere? It's clear that we have to provide mechanisms of relief for those individuals who are trying to move past that and restart their lives so that they can have a better chance.
Karen, thank you.
Thank you.
Karen York is Executive Director of the Job Opportunities Task Force. We will link to the report we've been discussing, The Criminalization of Poverty, How to Break the Cycle Through Policy Reform in Maryland, at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.